Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, where Dr. Michael Fully Love makes his first appearance at the Sydney Institute, and a welcome one. Michael Fully Love is Executive Director of the Lowy Institute in Sydney and a non-resident fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. He's a Rhodes Scholar and a former Prime Ministerial Advisor to Paul Keating, and he writes widely on global issues for publications such as the Sydney Morning Herald, the Australian, the New York Times, the Financial Times, the Daily Beast, and Foreign Affairs. Dr. Fully Love is here on the occasion of his most recent book, Rendezvous with Destiny, How Franklin D. Roosevelt and Five Extraordinary Men Took America into the War and into the World, which has just come out. He's also the editor of Men and Women of Australia, Our Greatest Modern Speeches, and the editor of Reports from a Turbulent Decade, covering the first 10 years of the Lowy Institute. But tonight, Michael Fully Love is going to talk for us on the topic of Franklin D. Roosevelt and America's European pivot. Michael, thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Jared, and thank you for the invitation to speak here at the Sydney Institute. The Sydney Institute is one of the great institutions of our city and our country, and it's an incredibly important part of our intellectual infrastructure. And if I might say so, I think Jared and Anne are also great institutions of our city and our country. And I was thinking about Jared on the way over here, actually, Jared, and I was thinking about the decline of the great newspapers of record. If you want to find out what happened in London in 1898, and I've done a lot of work in archives myself, you can go to the London Times, and it's the newspaper of record. And of course, with all the changes in the media industry, unfortunately, it's hard to identify a newspaper of record, as it were, these days. And I'm not saying you're like the London Times, Jared, but you do embody the sort of the corporate memory. He has a voluminous corporate memory, which he unleashes at different times against different people and in various causes, all of them honourable. But I think that sense of attention to detail and that memory is really important, because so often, even in my work, you find people addressing a problem as though it's something completely new, rather than something that has been addressed many times. The tyranny of the present is something that think tanks, I think, always need to fight against. So thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here to speak. And as Jared said, I'll talk about the book that I've just published a few months ago in Australia and in the United States, Rendezvous with Destiny, How Franklin Roosevelt and Five Extraordinary Men Took America into the War and into the World. And I think the title had something about Roosevelt's European pivot in the title. So in the second, at the end of, after I've told you a bit about the book, I want to make a few comments about what the contemporary relevance of the book is. Now, of course, every author on book tour does this, and Jared's seen it a million times before, but I genuinely think that there are things that we can learn about the challenges we face now from the challenges that the West faced in the period 1939 to 1941, and the way that Franklin Roosevelt and others grappled with them. Let me begin by telling you why I wrote this book. I wanted to write about the topic for three reasons. The first is that I have always believed that Franklin Roosevelt was the greatest statesman of the 20th century. This is a big claim and one that gets a lot of people angry. But he did a few things in his life. He saved American democracy from the Great Depression. He led the Allies to victory over the dictators. He won four consecutive presidential elections, and he did all this with a broken body in a time when disabilities were much less accepted than they are today. He was also, importantly for my purposes, for the purposes of an historian or a biographer, he was also a seductive and effervescent character. Winston Churchill said that meeting Franklin for the first time was like opening your first bottle of champagne. And this matters enormously, as Anne knows, when you're writing a book about somebody. I respect people who write biographies about Joseph Stalin and Adolf Hitler, but I personally couldn't do it. I would find it too grim and dark and depressing. Because you find when you're writing about these people over the course of many years, that you eventually end up having breakfast, lunch and dinner with them. And they're a part of your life. And, you know, eventually your family tires of them, even if you don't. And so the fact that Roosevelt was a charming character, as well as a deeply important one, contributed to my decision to write the book. Just in parenthesis, I started this book actually started as a master's thesis in Oxford in 1998, when I had to come up with a topic on which to quickly turn out a 30,000 word master's thesis. And it's interesting looking back at that decision. Most of my colleagues in the International Relations master's course at Oxford were gaming the situation, and they decided to write on a topic that they thought might be useful if they were to aspire to be a Dick Walcott in the Australian Foreign Service or in somebody else's diplomatic service. So they were all thinking, what is the smartest thing that I can write this thesis on that's going to produce me a job? And I just thought, oh, forget about it. You know, this is a rare opportunity in my life where I can get inside the head of somebody I've always admired, Franklin Roosevelt, but somebody I've never formally studied. So I'll just do that. I'm not going to try to make a decision based on my career. I'll just do it based on my interest. And it's funny how things turn out, because that master's thesis was very well received by the markers. They urged me a few years later to return to Oxford and to turn it into a doctorate, which I did. And then I put it aside again. And about 7 years after that, I'd signed up with an agent in New York, and we were tossing around book ideas. And I kept coming back to this idea. And the book is now being published in, you know, around the world. And it's so the reason I mention this is that what I thought was a sort of an anti-careerist decision turned out to be the best possible decision for my career that I could have made. And so, when occasionally, now that I'm an old man, when young people come to me and say, you know, what should I do on this and what should I write my honours thesis on, I always say to them, don't try to game it out and work out what is the smart thing to do. Write about what you're interested in. Write about what blows your hair back. Write about what you love. And that usually turns out to be the smart decision as well as the fun decision. So the first reason I decided initially to write a master's thesis, but subsequently a book, was that I believe Roosevelt was the most important statesman of the 20th century. The second reason I wanted to write about this period, about this topic, was that I believe the period between the start of the Second World War and America's entry into the Second World War in December 1941, those 2 years between September 1939 and December 1941, was the turning point of the 20th century. Now, this is another big claim, like my last one, that historians can take issue with. The reason I say that is twofold. First of all, the disposition of forces in the world changed utterly in this period. In the middle of the period, the wind was at Hitler's back. He had invaded the Low Countries. He had invaded France. France had fallen in an unimaginably short period of time. Really only the British Empire remained standing, and who knew for how long. And yet by the end of the period, by December 1941, the Axis forces faced the coalition that would ultimately, in my view, inevitably lead to their destruction. That is, the United States, the Soviet Union and the British Empire, of which, of course, Australia was a part. So the disposition of forces in this period changed completely. But also in this period, America was transformed, in my opinion, from a nervous, isolationist middle power, a country whose army just scraped into the top 20 armies in the world. I think it was 18th or 19th in terms of size in the beginning of this period. it transformed itself into a global leader. It was in this period that Roosevelt defeated isolationism as a viable, substantial political force in the United States. It was at the end of this period, of course, that America entered the war, and it emerged from the war in 1945, 1946, as the dominant power in the world. In a sense, the American century started in this period, the American century that we're still living in. When war broke out in Europe in September 1939, Americans were very anxious to isolate themselves from the conflict. In fact, the opinion polls in September 1939, after Germany invaded Poland, indicated that only 1 in 40 Americans favoured an immediate declaration of war against Hitler, even though he was obviously a maniac and a direct threat to American interests in the medium term. But only 1 in 40 Americans favoured an immediate declaration of war. Roosevelt wanted to help the democracies in their fight against the dictatorships, but he was hemmed in by public opinion and also by congressional opinion. His extraordinary achievement, and the achievement that I try to chart in this book, was to navigate these constraints and move a divided and hesitant America toward ever greater involvement in the European war. Within 2 years, America had rearmed and remobilised. A torrent of Lend-Lease aid was flowing eastward to Churchill's Britain and Stalin's Soviet Union, and the United States was waging an undeclared naval war against Germany in the Atlantic. By the time of Pearl Harbor in December 1941, America's course was set for global leadership. People often say simplistically, and I think it's a banal thing to say, that America entered the war because the Japanese bombed them at Pearl Harbor. Yes, that was the instigator. That was the decision on behalf of Tokyo that led to the American declaration of war against Japan. But I'm charting a much more long-term process over this period from September 1939 to December 1941, a deliberate process, a difficult process from Franklin Roosevelt to turn the aircraft carrier that was the United States and to head it towards involvement in this developing war. So in these 2 years, FDR turned America. But the question that I wanted to answer was, how did he turn it so quickly? How did Roosevelt come to have faith in the ability of Churchill and later Stalin and the countries that they led to withstand the force of the Axis attacks? How could he obtain the intelligence that he craved? How could he take the measure of these other leaders when he was trapped in a wheelchair in Washington? He distrusted the State Department. Roosevelt was said to have joked after Pearl Harbor, "My State Department is neutral in this war, and I hope it remains that way." So he distrusted the department. He regarded most US Foreign Service officers, as he said, as cookie pushers and conservatives in striped pants who were opposed to him and opposed to America deepening its involvement in the war. The ambassadorial reports he received from Joe Kennedy, for example, one of his worst appointments in London, and others, were invariably defeatist in tone. So how is it that Roosevelt came to the view that America should get involved in the war? How did he reach out to these other leaders, especially to Churchill and to Stalin, if he didn't trust his own diplomats? And that brings me to the third reason why I wanted to write this book. I wanted to write the kind of history that I like to read, and that is history about individuals, not just history about vast impersonal forces. I know that's the vogue amongst most academic historians, and I don't underrate the importance of vast impersonal forces. In fact, in my experience, if academics underestimate the role of individuals in human affairs, politicians overestimate the role of individuals in human affairs. If you speak to a prime minister or a president, you'll say, why was this treaty signed, or why was this international decision taken? They will often say, it's because I called the foreign minister or I and the president had a conversation in the margins of this conference. And often they overestimate, I think, the role that they play. But equally, I think historians underestimate the role that individuals play, and they tend to focus on these broad forces without bringing into focus the role of individuals. FDR turned in this period to five associates and sent them on special missions to Europe. Only one of them, the first one, had any background in international affairs at all. So this is why it's so fun. Most of these people are complete amateurs thrown into a Europe at war to perform incredibly important and difficult tasks for the leader of the free world. The first off the mark was Sumner Wells, a Chile patrician described by Time magazine as a casting director's dream of a diplomat. Wells was eventually railroaded out of the State Department for making homosexual advances to African-American railroad porters on the president's train, which would probably be inadvisable even in these enlightened times. But it was poison. It was suicide from a career point of view for him in those days. Wells was sent around Europe by Roosevelt in the spring of 1940 in the Phoney War. So the great European powers went to war in September 1939, but their armies didn't really meet on the field of battle until the middle of 1940. And in this intervening period, you had what was called a funny war or a phony war, where they were theoretically at war, there were naval engagements, there were a few engagements in the field, but there was not great battles on taking place. And in this very weird period, Sumner Wells travelled around Western Europe, meeting with Mussolini in Rome, Hitler and his acolytes in Berlin, the leaders of the Third Republic in Paris, and Neville Chamberlain's government in London. Roosevelt was looking for ways to help Britain and France, but he had not yet settled on an effective policy. And for that reason, I think the Wells mission, although it set the template for what followed, although it gathered important intelligence for Roosevelt, it was the least effective of the missions that I describe. By the late summer of 1940, of course, the world had changed utterly. Hitler had unleashed his blitzkrieg, France had fallen, and as I said earlier, only Britain and her empire remained standing. And now Wild Bill Donovan, war hero, lawyer, adventurer, and future spymaster, entered the scene. Bill Donovan later appointed by Roosevelt to establish the OSS, which was the forerunner of the CIA. And if any of you are ever lucky or unlucky enough to visit CIA headquarters in Langley, hopefully not rendered there, but if you ever visit the CIA, there's a bronze statue of Wild Bill in the foyer that you often see in movies, CIA agents carry and so on in Homeland, going in the foyer. There's a big statue there of Wild Bill. But I describe Wild Bill's earlier mission before he was America's spymaster. He was sent by Roosevelt really to assess whether the Brits could hold out against the Germans and whether London was likely to be a reliable ally, because Winston Churchill had only, of course, just become Prime Minister. His eyewitness report helped convince Roosevelt that this was a country worth backing, and American aid began to flow. In November 1940, that is 3 or 4 months after Wild Bill's mission, Roosevelt won an unprecedented third term as president, and his war policy toughened even further. He threw a lifeline to Britain in the form of Lend-Lease, and he dispatched three men to help secure it. Lend-Lease, of course, was a vast national legislative effort to fund, to provide money and material and even food aid and all sorts of aid to opponents of force. Roosevelt described it as Lend-Lease because he said, we're not giving this aid to the opponents of force, we're lending it to them. He said it's like, he drew this wonderful homely metaphor, it's like if your neighbour's house was on fire, you wouldn't sell him your garden hose so he could put out the fire. You'd lend him the hose, and when he'd finished with the hose, he'd return it to you. Now, this, of course, makes absolutely no sense. You can't compare a length of garden hose handed over a fence to the massive, unprecedented transfer of arms and material from a neutral, and remember, America was a neutral at this point, to some of the chief belligerents in the war. But Roosevelt managed to get away with it, with his charisma and his grin and the upturn, you know, the sort of the cigarette holder, and his charm. He managed to make this argument to the American people. And he sent three men in short succession, three men in the period of 6 weeks, to further the Lend-Lease policy. The first was Harry Hopkins, who really is probably the star of my book and my favourite character and one of the most lovable characters you will ever read about, unless you were his enemy, in which case you wouldn't like him much. But Hopkins was the scruffy, sickly social worker from Sioux City, Iowa, who became the whirling dervish at the centre of the New Deal. He was a rare, very rare figure who was central to both the first half of the Roosevelt administration, which was to do with the New Deal, and the second half of the Roosevelt administration, which was to do with winning the war. He moved into the White House on the day that Hitler invaded the Low Countries and ended up living in the White House just down the corridor from FDR for 3.5 years. And Roosevelt sent him to London to explain Lend-Lease to Winston Churchill. One of my favourite stories from the book came from this mission. Churchill realised immediately the importance of Hopkins to Britain's national life, and so he duchessed Harry Hopkins up and down the length and breadth of the British Isles. They jumped on and off warships at Scapa Flow, and he was introduced to the King and the Ministry, and he went to Chequers and all the rest of it. But there was one particular speech which I think was very important, where Churchill was hosting a private dinner for Hopkins. And Hopkins had been careful. He'd been supportive in what he said to Churchill, but he was also careful because he knew that anything he said would be taken as Roosevelt's view. And so Churchill was waiting. And, of course, American involvement in the war for the Brits at this time was an existential question. It's a matter of life and death. And so at this private dinner, Churchill gave one of his usual tours of the horizon, and then Hopkins was asked to give a speech. And Hopkins, who was a very frail person, whose stomach had been removed in a cancer operation a few years earlier, he was also suffering a mysterious nutritional disease. He was a very frail and weak person. Got onto his feet. His face was white and drawn, and he said a few words. He said, "Mr. Chairman, I'm not making speeches over here. I'm reporting what I see to Mr. Franklin Delano Roosevelt, my president, a great man, a very great man. But now that I'm here and on my feet, perhaps I might say, in the language of the old book," and here he paused and looked down the table straight at Winston, "Whither thou goest, I will go, and where thou lodgest, I will lodge. Thy people shall be my people, thy God shall be my God, even unto the end." And Churchill was in tears, and he was in tears for years afterwards when he'd tell this story. And Churchill's doctor, who was also in the room, Charles Wilson, wrote later, "He knew what it meant, even to us. The words seemed like a rope thrown to a drowning man." FDR's fourth envoy, Averell Harriman, was a protege of Hopkins, but very different from his mentor. He was an ambitious, handsome railroad heir and banker, and he was charged with delivering the aid to London. He lived in London, and he liaised between the British authorities and the American authorities, working out what the British actually needed and then trying to extract it from the Americans, who, you know, most of the bureaucrats and the military men in particular were actually very reluctant to give up this aid because they were trying to use it themselves to rearm. Harriman was a busy man, but he found time in the period to romance Winston Churchill's daughter-in-law, Pamela Churchill, married to Randolph, who was off serving in Egypt. We don't have to feel too sorry for Randolph because he was one of the era's great womanizers. He was said to have been in the arms of another woman on the night that Pamela gave birth to their first son, Winston Jr., for example. But anyway, Pamela, we know, was also quite diligent in that respect, as we found out for the rest of the century. And years later, of course, Pamela and Averell Harriman married, and she transformed herself into Pamela Harriman, socialite, fundraising queen, and mentor to President Clinton, who appointed her his ambassador to France. And Pamela died at a great age after swimming laps at the Ritz Hotel in Paris, which is personally how I want to go when my time comes. Roosevelt also put to work his rumpled, charismatic opponent in the 1940 presidential election, Wendell Willkie, the Indiana Dynamo, whose visit to London and Dublin was a public relations triumph, lifting British morale, winning over wary Americans, and edging the Republican Party away from isolationism. And the way that Roosevelt used Willkie was incredibly clever and at the same time devious. Willkie was a great forgotten figure of the 20th century, extremely attractive, extremely charming, a lifelong Democrat who switched to the Republican Party a year before he won the GOP's nomination because he knew he wanted to be president, basically. But he was a great internationalist at a time when all of the Republican leaders were, or almost all of the Republican leaders, were deeply isolationist. And once Roosevelt defeated Willkie, as he did by 5 million votes, he realised that he could use Willkie to try to wedge the Republican, the isolationist wing of the Republican Party, and try to appeal to the millions of Americans, Republican-leaning Americans, who'd voted for Wendell Willkie. So when Roosevelt heard that Willkie was going to London, which was a decision that Willkie took himself, he insisted that Willkie visit him at the White House. And Willkie called on him, and in the course of the meeting, Roosevelt had one of these flourishes that show the genius of the man. He took a piece of White House stationery and he wrote a letter to Winston Churchill for delivery by his recent rival, Wendell Willkie. And it was addressed to a certain naval person, which was a sort of a pet name that Roosevelt used for Churchill in light of the fact that Churchill had been First Lord of the Admiralty, which is the minister in charge of the Royal Navy. And the envelope was marked Kindness of Honourable Wendell Willkie. And the letter quoted contained lines from Longfellow's poem, The Building of the Ship. It read as follows. Dear Churchill, Wendell Willkie will give you this. He is truly helping to keep politics out over here. I think this verse applies to your people as it does to us. Sail on, O ship of state. Sail on, O union strong and great. Humanity, with all its fears, with all the hopes of future years, is hanging breathless on thy fate. As ever yours, Franklin D. Roosevelt. Finally, in the summer of 1941, that is a few months after Willkie had been to London, Hitler let the dice fly, ordering the invasion of Russia. And again, it was the frail Harry Hopkins who dominated proceedings, returning to Britain to confer with Churchill and making a death-defying journey to Moscow to meet with Joseph Stalin, the first significant Western official to meet with Stalin after the German invasion of Russia. Hopkins' mission gave Roosevelt the confidence to gamble on aiding the Soviet Union against the advice of most of his counsellors. Hopkins, in a sense, provided a reference, a character reference, not to the Soviet Union himself, because he was not under any illusions about the character of life in the Soviet Union, but a character reference for the Red Army and for the ability of the Soviet Union to withstand the Axis attacks, just as Bill Donovan had a year earlier provided a character reference to the ability of the British military to hold out against the Germans. A few months later, on December the 7th, 1941, Japan attacked Pearl Harbor. The United States declared war on Japan. Germany declared war on the United States. And at last, America was in the war. And FDR was a war president. So that's really my book. I might just take 5 minutes, if I can, before I wrap up, Jared, I promised at the beginning that I'd make an argument to you about the contemporary relevance of this book. Just as another reason as to why everybody should buy it, obviously. I want to argue that this story is very relevant to America's pivot to Asia. To me, President Obama's most important and most interesting foreign policy initiative in his first term was his attempt to pivot the United States toward Asia. Basically, the argument goes like this. The country took a strategic detour by invading Iraq and by prolonging its occupation of Afghanistan. America is overly invested in the Middle East and it's under-invested in Asia, where many of its greatest future challenges and opportunities lie. And now, as President Obama sought to rebalance the country's portfolio. Wealth, and this makes powerful strategic sense to me, and not only because I'm an Australian, which is an ally of the United States, but I spend my, you know, a lot of my day job is analysing US foreign policy, and it makes powerful strategic sense, I think. Wealth and power are shifting eastward. We know about the, everybody in this room knows about the enormous growth in China's economy and in the Asian economy. We know that if the economic outlook in Asia is positive, the security outlook is increasingly unpredictable. The Taiwan Strait is calm, but there are worrying tensions on the Korean Peninsula and in the East China Sea and the South China Sea. And these challenges, to me, make the pivot urgent. Because if Washington can't reassure its allies that sequestration and defence cuts and shutdowns and potential defaults and general dysfunction in Washington will not reduce the US military presence in Asia, then US allies in Asia may take matters into their own hands, which could be unpredictable. Equally, China may conclude that America lacks staying power and resolve. So Washington has to walk a fine line. It needs to reassure allies without emboldening them. It needs to project strength to China without projecting belligerence. Here's the problem. It is remarkably difficult to pivot a country as large and diverse as the United States. What I describe in the book, in a sense, is a successful pivot of the country, where Roosevelt pivoted it outward from being a domestically focused country to an outward-looking country, and he pivoted it towards Europe. Because even though America entered the war when Japan attacked the United States, Roosevelt never departed from the Germany first policy, because he saw the greater evil as residing in Berlin, not in Tokyo, the greater threat to American security interests coming from Berlin, coming from Germany, not from Japan. So Roosevelt was responsible for this pivot, and it was a campaign of subtle diplomacy carried off with great flair. There were endless tactical shifts, but beneath them a clear and inexorable direction can be discerned. It took supreme presidential concentration, the diversion of resources on a massive scale. It took dozens of speeches, fireside chats, decisions, conversations and meetings. That's what it takes to pivot a country as large and difficult and rancorous with as many divergent interests as the United States. Obama's challenge is not as urgent or as deadly as Roosevelt's. Plainly, a rising China is in no way analogous to the Axis regimes. Yet without a strong US presence, the region faces strategic uncertainty, power imbalances, and the risk of destabilizing rivalry. And that's why I'm concerned. As a friend of the United States, an admirer of the United States' role in the world, which is why I spent years of my life writing this book, you look at the United States at the moment. On the one hand, you have somebody like Secretary of State John Kerry, who's a very admirable public servant, very impressive in many ways, but appears to be an old-style Atlanticist, whose first overseas trip as Secretary of State was not to Asia, which is where Hillary came, but to London and Paris and Bonn and Ankara and the Gulf, who's made endless visits to bring peace to the Holy Land, and I wish him luck with that, who has justifiably put an enormous emphasis on ending the bloodshed in Syria, on dealing with the Iranian nuclear program and on the peace process between the Israelis and the Palestinians. But still, you know, where is the focus on Asia? Where is the kind of focus that Obama projected when he spoke in Canberra a couple of years ago? Where is the focus on the pivot? And that's not even to mention the incredible dysfunction that you see in Washington at the moment. I know a lot of my American friends, you know, wave their hands and they say, well, look, of course President Obama had to stay in Washington because there's all this stuff happening. And I agree with that. It's completely understandable that he did that. And yet, what does it say about the United States when the President of the United States cannot say with authority, a month in advance, a week in advance, where he will be when he cannot turn up at an event that he has previously committed to attend. It's not a reflection on President Obama. It's a reflection on where the United States has managed to get to. Ladies and gentlemen, in closing, let me return to World War II. Let me say that one of the things I loved about this period was how charming the characters were. FDR once cabled Churchill, "It is fun to be in the same decade with you." And it was fun, and it was fun to write about them. And my favourite story, which I'll end on, Jared, is a story about a conference between FDR and Winston in January 1942, just after Pearl Harbor. Winston immediately got on a warship and sailed to Washington to confer with his new ally. And these were less formal times, and so instead of putting up in a hotel, Roosevelt invited Churchill and his senior aides to stay at the White House. And so upstairs at the residence, along with Franklin and Eleanor and Harry Hopkins, who was down the corridor, and Eleanor's lady friends who had rooms, and FDR's various secretaries who had rooms, was Winston Churchill and various of his aides. And one day, Roosevelt accidentally surprised Churchill. And he'd come up with an idea. He wanted to tell Churchill the idea. He wheeled himself into Churchill's bedroom. He was horrified to find that Churchill was having a bath in a special bathtub that he'd instructed to have set up in the middle of the bathtub, because, as many people know, Winston had peculiar personal habits. And Roosevelt was mortified in a very waspish way, and he apologised. He made to leave. He started to wheel himself out, but Churchill would have none of it. And according to very good historical sources, he rose like a sea monster from the bathtub, and he stood before Roosevelt, naked, plump, pink and dripping. And unashamed, he declared, "The Prime Minister of Great Britain has nothing to conceal from the President of the United States." It's difficult to imagine that kind of encounter between Xi Jinping and President Obama, isn't it? And so perhaps that's a good thing. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Many thanks to Michael Foley Love. As I said, the occasion of this talk relates to the publication of Rendezvous with Destiny. Janet Grundy's got copies outside. I'm sure that Michael would be happy to sign any after the event. And so we come to, and I shouldn't say, this book has been extremely well reviewed. I think of all Australian writers in recent years, it's probably the book that's got the most notice in certainly in North America and in Europe. So we come to question discussion. We've got till the top of the hour. You've told us about the famous five who President Roosevelt sent off to Europe, and you briefly mentioned one not so famous, Joseph Kennedy. Now, how come someone as perceptive in judging people as the President was could appoint to such a key position in Britain as the ambassador, someone like Joseph Kennedy, who was a defeatist at best and probably a sellout merchant? How did that happen?
Do you want me to take these from here?
Yep. No.
Look, it's a good question. I think my answer is everyone makes mistakes. I think Kennedy was the worst diplomatic appointment that Roosevelt made, but it actually wasn't the only bad diplomatic appointment he made. His ambassador to Moscow in this period, Lawrence Steinhardt, was also inappropriate, was also sort of defeatist-minded and was not alive to the kind of support that Roosevelt wanted to give to Stalin. But I think part of the answer is that although Roosevelt was very sensitive and acute in his personal dealings with people and was a genius, as I said, in the Wilkie example and others, pardon me, in terms of manipulating people, there was also a slight carelessness to some of Roosevelt's appointments, where he was not a sort of an MBA president, Jared. He was someone who would sometimes appoint someone almost thoughtlessly because he knew if he didn't like the appointment, he'd go round them. And that's what he did with these advisors. He appointed Kennedy but didn't like Kennedy and regarded him very quickly as a defeatist and an isolationist, and so ignored him and went around him and sent Bill Donovan without properly informing Kennedy. And he just did that. His governing method was chaotic. He would often give the same task to multiple people. He would see anybody who wanted to see him. But there was some method to his madness too, because although he made mistakes, as he did with the Kennedy appointment, and although this would not, his governing style would not be taught at the Department of Government at the University of Sydney as sort of best practice, that you, you know, have a rational org structure and everybody has individual jobs, what Roosevelt got out of it was a massive amount of intelligence. He was able to test the arguments of different people against each other. He was able to see who would do the job better by giving the same job to two people, and then he'd reward the person who did the job better. So all I can say is that his governing style was messy and chaotic, but on the whole, it worked.
Okay, thanks for that. Now, we go on. If I have to repeat a question, it's for the podcast. So we go down there. Yeah.
You spoke about the pivot in what was a very short election campaign in 1940. I think on the 23rd of October, a big speech.
Yes.
Roosevelt, paraphrasing, said,
yes,
I've told you once, I'll tell you again, our boys will never fight overseas.
Yes.
How did he pivot? Was he lying to the public? Because
right, so the question is, how come when Roosevelt said in 1940 that our boys would never fight overseas that he could so quickly change?
Yeah. It's amazing how politicians sometimes get away with that, don't they? look, I think once you're elected, you're elected. And then you create your own reality, as a Bush administration appointee said. Roosevelt put on hold he sort of put in suspended animation the aid program to Britain to some extent in the lead up to the vote in November. He did make that famous speech at the Boston Gardens or somewhere like that, where he said, "We will not be sending our boys into any foreign wars." But then, when one of his advisors said, "But you know, can you really definitely make that point, Mr. President? What if someone attacks us?" And he says, "Ah, but then it wouldn't be a foreign war, would it?" So he was very clever in sending that message, in calming the horses. Don't worry, we're not going to necessarily get involved in these wars under my presidency. And yet, as soon as he was elected, as I said, his policy hardened very significantly. He came up with Lend-Lease, and the whole nature of US policy changed.
But to some extent, that's true. But without Pearl Harbor and without passing the Lend-Lease legislation, which took a while, it wasn't until March 41, you really would have had a different outcome, surely, because he was also trying to prevail against what was an extremely strong feeling, even within the British Foreign Service, right through 1939 and even into 40, that they could do a deal with Hitler. And to what extent, really, did the Americans need Pearl Harbor to have actually got them in there? Because it did become their war.
To what extent do the Americans need Pearl Harbor to get them into the war?
This is an incredibly complicated historical debate. And if you ask 10 historians, they would give you 10 different views. So, for example, some people would argue that until America was attacked at Pearl Harbor, Roosevelt had not decided to enter the war. Other people would argue to you that by early 1941, he was absolutely determined to enter the war. I would come somewhere in the middle and say that by about July, August 1941, by the time that, for example, Roosevelt was meeting Churchill at the Atlantic Conference on a warship with the leading belligerent, it was obvious to Roosevelt that every step that he was taking would inevitably involve America in the conflict. I mentioned before that America was engaged in an undeclared naval war against Germany in the Atlantic. I mean, it was only happenstance that one of those encounters, for example, one of those encounters could easily, in this period, have led to a shooting war between Germany and the United States. So I think Japan crystallised things for the Americans. It assisted Roosevelt because it meant that he was blameless, in a sense, when it came to public opinion. No one could say, you took us into the war. He could say, the Japanese took us into the war. And we declared war on the Japanese, and then Germany declared war on us. But my own view is that even if the Japanese had not attacked America at Pearl Harbor, then America would have been in the war within a matter of months.
Right, so there's a question here.
Yeah, I thought it was a marvellous speech, thank you.
Thank you.
And I'm just saying, nothing like war to focus your mind on. But it also seemed that one of the things in favour of Roosevelt's decision was the American economy, which had been flat in the Depression, the Liberty ships and all the lead and lease, was consuming their economy along, which makes it positive.
Yeah.
But what worries me, and I think your important thing about Asia at the moment, is there doesn't seem to be anything to really focus people's minds. I mean, I think they should focus and have a pivot, but how do you get them together to pivot and focus on?
I think that's right, and I think it goes back to the caveat I put at the end of my argument about the Asian pivot, which is that the periods are not comparable. And it does focus your mind when you've got a maniac like Hitler and you've got the military government in Tokyo, expansionist governments, and it's much harder. The challenge of pivoting to Europe towards Asia for the United States now is much more complicated and subtle. It requires you to really make an argument that sometimes the important things are not exactly the same as the urgent things. Syria is urgent, but that doesn't mean that Asia is not important. But whatever it takes, if Obama's going to deliver on the pivot, he does need to focus his mind. And I was amazed that Obama gave a speech at the General Assembly a couple of weeks ago, and in which he sort of laid out his foreign policy for the rest of his second term. And of course, I suppose he emphasised elements that had a security dimension because he was speaking in New York. But still, he talked about Syria, he talked about the Iranian nuclear program, and he talked about the Israelis and the Palestinians. And Asia got only a glancing reference. And I think that's the wrong balance to strike.
So there's a question down there. Yeah. Yes.
Why precisely did Roosevelt see Hitler as being a principal opponent of American interests?
Why precisely did Roosevelt see Hitler as the principal opponent of United States interest?
I think for a few reasons. I mean, there's a couple of ways of answering that. I mean, one is to say that Roosevelt himself was a Europeanist. He felt his European antecedents very strongly. He knew Europe very well. He travelled there often as a child and as a young man. I think that objectively the behaviour of Hitler was more alarming. I mean the Japanese were pursuing an expansionist policy in pursuit of natural resources, but would I, going back in sort of putting myself in Roosevelt's mind, would I have said that that is on a par with the rise of the dictators in especially in Germany and in Italy, their treatment of their internal populations, the incredible speed with which they overcame, for example, the army of France, which was regarded at the time as more formidable than the army of Germany. I think this rocked very long-held American conceptions of where their security rested. They always felt that the Atlantic was this great moat that protected them from European, the kind of European ructions from which many Americans had fled. And suddenly that free security, in a sense, disappeared with the fall of all these European countries and the threatening of Britain and the British Empire. The final way I'd answer the question is to say that Roosevelt misjudged the Japanese. And he misjudged the Japanese in the same way that Stalin misjudged the Germans. Roosevelt believed that he could keep the Japanese, the conflict in the Pacific, off the boil, even while he dialed up the heat on the war in the Atlantic. So you see, in this whole period, he's saying to his staff, they're saying, we should send more warships to Pearl Harbor or this part of Asia. He said, I don't have the ships to spare. I need them in the Atlantic. He felt that he could contain the Japanese. But what he felt was checking an unreasonable Japanese advance, the Japanese saw as an intolerable policy of containment. And so he was surprised by Pearl Harbor.
There's a question here somewhere, I think. Here, and then we go to Tom down the back. You've got to be quick now, yeah?
Michael, thank you for a most interesting speech and a very readable book.
Oh, thank you.
I was particularly impressed by the bravery of someone of your particular characteristics who would use the expression, whatever blows your hair off.
I use that in my speech, not in my book, David.
You referred to the US being overrepresented in, I think was a term you used, in the Middle East. The projections of the US will be self-sufficient in energy within a couple of years. Surely is going to have huge geopolitical ramifications, and I wonder whether that would in fact help the greater attention to Asia, which you suggested might be highly desirable.
Look, it'll have an effect, although even if America were to import no Middle Eastern oil, the fact that so much of the world's oil comes from the Middle East means that that still has an incredibly important role in setting the price of oil, which is a global commodity. So it still has real-world security implications, even if they're not importing oil themselves. But the other thing I'd say is that it's not true, although a lot of people think it is the case, it's not true that US policy in the Middle East or its attachment to the Middle East is just dictated by oil. You can't explain, for example, America's attachment to its Israeli ally by reference to oil. The Israelis don't have any oil. You can't explain, really, their intervention in Iraq, which in my view was a very foolhardy decision. You can't explain that, really, with reference to oil. I mean, elements of the left tried to make that argument at the time, but it wasn't. It wasn't because of that. It was because of a different ideological argument about America's role in the region. Is American behaviour on Syria determined by oil? I don't really think it is. So I agree that the changes in the global energy market are a factor, but they don't completely explain. They've never explained US behaviour on the Middle East in the past, so they won't in the future.
Tom?
Michael, at the end of the Second World War, America held half the globe's resources and also had half the military power on the planet. In relation to the framework for its ability to project its power and its influence in the Asian theatre, do you think that there's a new paradigm that has to be developed, or a new framework that has to be thought of that doesn't exist now to enable America to do what they like to do?
Question is, do the Americans need a new framework to do what they want to do in Asia because their power's not as great now as it was 50 years ago?
I'd have to think about whether I agree with the sort of underlying assumption in the question. I mean, they were, at the end of the Second World War, they were enormously powerful in relative terms. They are the only country with a nuclear weapon at that point. And yet they also faced a very determined and formidable ideological and geopolitical enemy in the Soviet Union. And Russia these days is a much reduced power. So I know what you mean. I think I agree with you that, but I guess I'd say this. If you look at any America's power position at any time in the 20th century, they've always, since the end of the Second World War, they've always been the top dog, but they've always faced formidable adversaries. Maybe China will turn out to be a more formidable adversary than the Soviet Union, but they've always faced opponents and adversaries, and so I think they do need to explore. They can't. What I think the lesson that one would learn, I wouldn't go right back to the Second World War. I'd go right back to the noughties. I think the lesson that America has to learn from its intense involvement in the Middle East, especially the invasion of Iraq, is that you have to be careful, you have to be prudent, you have to be absolutely sure before you go around invading and occupying other countries, and therefore you need to use a lot of different tools at your disposal. I would agree with that.
Right down the back corner. The back corner, yep.
You mentioned the involvement of the US Navy in operations of the Atlantic before Iraq.
The question is, in the undeclared war in the Atlantic, what would have happened if a German or a US ship had been sunk? How would the President have explained that?
There were lots of incidents, and the way that Roosevelt used it to ratchet up the pressure on the Germans and to arouse public opinion against Germany. And so there was an incident, for example, where a German U-boat fired on an American warship, and Roosevelt basically misrepresented the terms of that engagement to make it out that to make it appear that the U-boat had behaved more aggressively than it actually had. And he used that to he declared an unlimited national emergency. And he what you see in this period is Roosevelt taking incidents like that, whether it's a naval incident or a speech that Hitler gives, and using it step by step, gradually but deliberately and inevitably, to ratchet up the pressure and to harden the policy. Okay, you're going to do that. In that case, we're going to extend further the naval patrol, the section of the Atlantic that the US Navy will take responsibility for in patrolling. Okay, if you're going to do that, we're now going to radio out and declare the presence of any Axis warships in the Atlantic. All right, if you're going to do that, then in that case, we're going to increase the aid that we supply to Britain. So that's what he did. He used every incident and every means at his disposal to shift public opinion and to move America toward deeper involvement in the war.
We're getting very close to the end of this question here. Yeah.
Was Hitler surprised by Pearl Harbor?
The question was Hitler surprised by Pearl Harbor?
It's a good question, and I think Hitler was surprised by Pearl Harbor. The question that people often ask is why did America not use the attack on Pearl Harbor to declare war on Hitler? Given that Roosevelt had, as I've said, a Germany first policy, and given that I've made this argument that he was moving America closer and closer to the war. And I think the thing that I find most compelling is that Roosevelt believed on the basis of cable intercepts that if Japan and the United States entered a war, then Hitler would enter the war at Japan's side. So I think Hitler, as far as I know, and I'm not an expert on that particular issue, as far as I know, Hitler was surprised, but he also, they'd had many discussions about Hitler, Germany and Japan had many discussions within the Axis about different eventualities. And on that basis, I think Roosevelt believed that he could limit the US declaration of war just to Japan in the very great hope that Germany would make life easy for him by declaring war against the United States, as they did 3 days after America declared war on Japan.
Final question. It's quite a risk for an Australian to write a history of the United States or any other country when you don't live there. So what's been the response of your American friends to what you've said about their country in this crucial period?
The response has been lovely. I mean, the book has been very generously received by readers and reviewers. I think one of the nice things about America, and I lived in America for a couple of years working at the Brookings Institution, is because the Americans are used to being the centre of attention, they don't actually think it's weird when foreigners want to write about them. I notice when Australians encounter this, we often bristle, or why you want to write this book, or you have an American accent but you want to run for parliament, or we often bristle. The Americans take this in their stride. They think it completely normal that everyone in the world is as obsessed about them as they are themselves. So generally, basically, they never raise the question. I mean, they will compliment me on my charming Australian accent, but beyond that, they don't worry about it. In terms of the risk, the final thing I'll say is that I mentioned in my acknowledgements Owen Harries, who's been very helpful in my career, and he did give me some advice that I treasured, and that is, if you're going to go swimming, swim in the deep water, not the shallows. So I think when you spend several years of your life writing a book, why not bite off a really big issue involving big characters and with big stakes and big countries and see how well you can do.
Many thanks. Well, I'll be very brief because we're right on time. Sorry, we couldn't get to everyone tonight, but we did our best. Many thanks to Michael Follilove for a fine presentation. He's made an important contribution as a commentator and historian in Australia. And, of course, the Lowy Institute, of which Michael is the executive director, has made a very significant impact on Australia over the last decade since it was established. So, for tonight, well done to Michael Follilove. Thank you, and best wishes for your book. And I'm sure you'll be back again in the future. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.